Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Turfgrass Epistemology. I'm Travis Shaddix. It's March 27th, 2024. From Lexington, Kentucky. It's going to be a beautiful day today. It's probably ideal conditions for cool season grass growth today. It's been it rained mostly yesterday, just sprinkled and probably a quarter inch or less. Not much, but a little bit of moisture. Today's 100% sunshine. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. So the grass is going to be growing. And I think this is prime time. So it's that time of year. It's that season. Good morning, Internet Surfer, Gray Fox, Looney, Randy, Connecticut Cubanican, Chadley Hamill. Thank you all for being members of the channel. Today is the last open public morning show for, well, until further notice. Tomorrow night will be Thursday night show, and it'll be a public. It'll remain public on Thursday nights, but for the members, the morning show will be exclusively for the members. So I encourage you to consider being a member. It's not much. You can get in for $5 a month. It's rough estimates basically is it's $1 a show. So if you think the when you're listening and you go, well, you know, is this of any value to me? Well, if it's worth $1, that's all the membership is $1 a show on the morning for the morning. The Thursday night's open access. So if it's worth $1, then consider becoming a member. And if you want to support Turfgrass Research, that's another reason to be a member. So next week, I'll be in Jamaica. So I'll be gone all of next week. And then the Monday of the following week, which I guess is April 8th, is the solar eclipse. So there won't be any show that day because the public schools are out on that day to experience a once-in-a-lifetime event, a total solar eclipse. We probably won't be able to actually get into the total solar path because the highways are just going to be completely packed, and there's the hotels were going for like $500 a night. So we didn't actually plan on getting in the exact path of the total eclipse, but you'll be able to see it from Lexington. If not, we'll go to Louisville to some friends' houses or something. Who knows? A little further west is where the eclipse goes. So anyway, after today, the next morning show will be on April the 15th. And then after that, of course, it'll be a normal Monday, every Monday, as long as my kids are in school. Not sure what I'm going to do during the summer yet, but I'll keep it going in the summer one way or the other. So that's the plan. Good morning, Yard Hard. Good morning. We're going to continue going over potassium today. I'm going to redo a paper that I did early on in the show. I rewatched part of it and I wasn't real happy with it. And there was only two or three people watching back then anyway. So you probably haven't seen it. So I'm going to redo it. I'm going to do it with some PowerPoint slides to show the results. So hopefully the results are a little clearer. And I'm also going to show some information about timing of soil tests. This particular paper has soil test values over different seasons, spring, summer, or fall. And the influence of that is a little clearer in this paper than some of the other ones. I've actually shown two papers in the past that one of them is extremely clear. The other one was a little less obvious, where the soil test values in many locations is lowest in the spring. And because of that, that's generally the preferred time. Because if we're going to identify a deficiency in nutrients using a soil test, it's going to be when the soil test nutrient levels are at their lowest during the season. And there's been several papers show that generally the spring is the time where the nutrients are the lowest. And today's paper is not going to be any different. It's just much clearer in this paper. Good morning, Lush. So I'm going to go over that today too. So that's the end of the paper today. They have some, the author has some, a table that I'm going to show in a graph format that makes it painfully obvious which season you probably should consider soil sampling. The idea is if you sample in the highest point and you go, well, my soil values are adequate. Well, at other times of the year, it's going to be much lower. In some cases, it could be half that value. In that case, you might actually experience a deficiency. So you want to sample when it's at the, when the nutrient levels are at their lowest. The other thing was, there was something else I was going to show, or I was going to mention. It had to do, can't remember now what it was. Should have made a note. Maybe I'll remember it throughout the day. Randy from Bulgaria says, I like morning shows because I can watch them live. Your night shows are 4 a.m. for him. I think Randy, you're in Bulgaria. So many Europeans will be members if they want to interact and ask questions live. In my currency, it's $3 per month. Okay. Whatever your currency is per month. Yeah, I mean, I guess whatever it's worth is up to the consumer, I suppose. But there's been a couple occasions on the Calendly, on my consultations through calendly.com/Travis Shattuck, there's been a couple occasions where I've ran the math. One person actually has consulted twice, once early on and then once several months later to confirm some purchasing and fertilizer blends and so forth. And we ran the math on it. If your business, either in sport turf or golf or lawn care or sod production, if your business is big enough to order a ton of fertilizer, then you're able to then custom blend what you want in it. Many distributors are able to custom blend whatever you want as long as you can order a ton. And in this particular example that I recall, the turf manager was ordering a ton. I think he was actually ordering 6 or 7 pallets. And from what he was using, when we made some adjustments and kind of eliminated some of the waste and reformulated it so that what's in there was all, everything was needed, he ended up saving like $1,500 per order, per 6 or 7 pallets, whatever he was ordering. And I'm like, well, that's worth it. just by that one order, you save $1,000. If you include the cost of paying $1 for the show or paying for a Calendly consultation, I mean, clearly he saved a lot of money. So that's what I'm going for. In fact, I know the person I'm speaking of is in chat today. I didn't want to mention anybody's name, so I didn't want to. I'll leave it alone, but unless he wants to say something, he can say something. But good morning, Brady. Good morning, Transition Zone guy. Thank you both for being members. Raining in Virginia. Yeah, we had some drizzle and rain here in Kentucky, in Lexington. It was a sort of a long path, and it was drizzling and raining. Okay, guys, let's get into the article. Let's get into the scoreboard. Remember, I'm keeping a scoreboard on potassium, the various articles I've gone over, and I added one yesterday. That was on St. Augustine grass. And the scoreboard looks like this, where we have now about 6 in the positive column. Nearly every one of those 6 that shows a positive result are on low-case soils. In fact, I think they all are on low-case soils. A couple of them are in Florida, where the sand and no potassium bearing minerals, and the potassium levels are 10 parts per million, malic 1, or maybe as high as 18 malic 3, and this one was in New Jersey on putting greens. So when we see a positive response on the scoreboard, keep in mind it's not equally weighted. They are almost always on low-case soils. In fact, I'm willing to say they're all on low-case soils. When we see a positive response to the applying potassium in those cases, it's almost always from a very small amount of potassium. It's not from large quantities. It's not from 1-to-1 N to K ratio fertilizers. It's usually from 2-to-1s or less. So like a 20-0-10 or a 30-0-15, something like that, a 2-to-1 N to K ratio. where you're applying about half as much potassium as you would nitrogen. That's generally where you'll see the maximum response in adding more and more potassium. And these studies has not, they've not concluded that that's useful. So that's the take-home message from all the positive articles in this column. Low-K soils, the response was from just a little bit of potassium and adding more and more once you reach the maximum, which was about 2:1 into K, adding more and more potassium did not help. Then we have a column here where there's nothing happened, and that's 9 or 10 studies where nothing happened. And we actually have a column where there's negative responses to potassium. We have 7 articles that I've gone over, at least, that showed negative or concluded there was a negative response to applied potassium in turf grass systems. So that's the scoreboard. So if you're keeping track, the nones and the negatives are greatly outweigh the positives. So that's why I generally don't recommend applying any potassium at all unless you have somehow diagnosed a deficiency, because it's usually quite wasteful. In some cases, as you see on the chart, as you see on the scoreboard, in some cases there can be a positive response, but you want to document that and make sure that that's the case before you just go out and start spreading it all over creation, because you might end up having a negative response and not even realize that's what caused it, right? Good morning, Super TA. Thank you for being a member. Jeremy Bezeal? I don't know how to pronounce your last name, but if you let me know, I'll try to remember how to pronounce your name correctly. Good morning. That's a new name to me, but thank you for coming. Ignacio asks, is there any chance that I can give an idea of the planned topics covered in the following months? Well, that's a very good question. In May, the answer is basically no, but I'll tell you, in May, there's going to be at least a week, if not more, on mental health and psychology of turf grass in the turf grass industry. So it'll be things such as neurodiversity in the workplace, such things such as ADHD, autism. There'll be some psychology papers regarding the prioritization of information, such as the Dunning-Kruger effect. So May will be mostly centered around psychology of turf. Okay, what's going on in the mind? Whether it's mental health or whether it's, something to do with rationalization in your mind. That'll be in May. April will be mostly, it'll only be half of April because I'm gone in the first week, and then the first Monday or the second Monday I'm gone. But April, I haven't quite figured out yet. I wanted to do phosphorus, but I can't do phosphorus in half of a month. So I may end up pulling in an author to come back to do a paper that she was unable to do when I was doing nitrogen because she was not available. But so I haven't figured out what I'm going to do in April yet. I can show you the list of papers in my folder. if that helps, there's hundreds. But if you're a member, feel free to put it on the community tab and say, hey, these are, maybe I'll put that in the members community tab and put that as a poll or just a question to the members. Like what topics are of greatest interest to you? And I'll do my best to follow that if I can. So that's sort of the best I can do for you. I'm sorry, Ignacio. I don't really have much clarity, much more clarity than that. The summertime, I have a kids home, but they're in summer school sometimes and summer camps and stuff. So I'm pretty sure I can keep things going during the morning, during the summer. There'll be a week or two where I can't do anything because we're on vacation or something. And you know how that goes. But I do have a list of topics that everybody wants me to cover, and I appreciate your input. People want me to cover humic acids and, biostimulants and biochar and soil testing and all that stuff. So we'll get to it, I think for the most part, I've got a routine down and people know that when I'm going to be on the air and when I'm, you know, for the most part, they know I'm going to be Monday morning, Thursday evening. So it's, I'm not going anywhere, you know? So I know we want to get all this information. I mean, you can always go to Google Scholar and TGIF, which is a turfgrass information file, and search for those topics on your own and explore the literature on your own. If you're anxious to get that information, it's all in there. So, but I'll get to it. I wish I could tell you I was better planned and scheduled such that I had all these topics laid out for the several months ahead of time, but I don't. All right, let's get to the paper. The paper today is by an author named Dr. Jerry Sartain, and the title of the paper is Tifway Bermudagrass Response to Potassium Fertilization. Dr. Sartain was at the University of Florida since 1971 or 72, something around that number. He did his graduate work on soybeans, if I'm not mistaken, and he came to University of Florida in the 70s and started doing work with turfgrass. And he did some other work here and there with some other vegetables with other groups here and there, but the bulk of his work was in turfgrass. And this paper was being analyzed and being conducted, or the research was being conducted when I was a graduate student at UF, and I helped a little bit with some of the treatments and put them out and collected harvests and things like that for Dr. Sartain whenever he was doing his work. I was doing my master's. I started my master's in 99, I guess it was. It must have been 99, and then I was there all the way through 2004 or so. So this was right in the middle of when I was doing a lot of work there too. So I was familiar with this study and where they were doing the work and, you know, all that stuff and how they analyzed it. So it's a pretty good paper. It's very simple to follow, and we'll get into it. Okay. The introduction is, you know, a typical introduction. Let me do this. Let me get my pen here. There we go. Having some difficulty this morning getting this thing going. Okay. Nitrogen requirements for growth of Tifway Bermudagrass have been well established to maintain good quality Tifway Bermudagrass at least, a quarter to three quarters of a pound of nitrogen. What? Hang on a second. That was in Georgia. That's in grams per square meter. Hang on. I got to do that math. Hang on a second. I wasn't prepared for that. That was in kilograms. So yeah, between 4 and 6 pounds of nitrogen were required in Georgia for acceptable Tifway Bermudagrass. So nitrogen in Bermudagrass is pretty well established. I mean, we know generally based upon the location and the desired expectations and so forth, how much nitrogen you're going to need to apply to, you know, meet some sort of acceptable standard for Bermudagrass. But potassium's different. Okay. So he says, anyway, I'll go into it. Typically, turfgrass accumulates about twice as much nitrogen as potassium. So these elements are recommended to be applied at a 2-to-1 N:K ratio. This is by Alturgeon in the 85. Bruce Augustine, 92, reported that turfgrass managers use relatively large amounts of potassium, generally at levels equal to or exceeding the rate of nitrogen. So it just, I think it's just coincidental that the turfgrass tissue generally will have about twice as much nitrogen as potassium. And we end up recommending about twice as much nitrogen as potassium, or half as much potassium as nitrogen. We end up recommending about that. I think that's mostly coincidental because potassium, at least in this case in Florida, potassium doesn't have the same fates and transformations as, say, phosphorus or iron, okay, or sulfate, okay. It generally is less interactive in terms of gaseous losses and things like that. So, or organic consumption and, you know, transformations, those don't really happen. Potassium doesn't enter into any organic compound in the plant. So we end up recommending a 2-to-1 N:K ratio for turf grasses. And I think it's just coincidental that the tissue also happens to be about a 2-to-1 N:K ratio. But the reason I'm saying that is don't assume that ratio in the tissue is being recommended because that, or the ratio in the fertilizer is being recommended because that's the ratio in the tissue. And then therefore we should also have the same ratio for all the other fertilizer components. Don't assume that that's the case. Okay. So Peacock in 97 reported no improvement in turf quality, color, rooting, or cold tolerance of TIF green Bermuda grass as a result of increasing rates of potassium. We didn't go over the Charles Peacock paper in 97, but that's another paper where there was no benefit. Snyder and Cesar found there was a benefit, but those were cases. And we just went over that paper a day or two ago. That was a case where the potassium in the soil was very low and the benefit from applying potassium occurred at a 2-to-1 indicator ratio. That was in South Florida. Beard and Reike in 66 stated that turfgrass winter survival was maximized when K rates were about 1/2 the rate of nitrogen. Okay. So there's plenty of evidence in the literature that a 2-to-1 is the most efficient ratio. There's occasionally some pieces here and there where a 1-to-1 is recommended, but there's at least one paper, maybe two, where the reason 1-to-1 was recommended instead of a 2-to-1 was because 1-to-1 was the least rate chosen in that paper. They didn't have a 2-to-1 in that paper. They only had a 1-to-1, 1-to-2, 1-to-3, 1-to-4, and 1-to-5, so forth. So if they had a 2-to-1, maybe that would be the ratio, but they didn't use that rate in that paper. And I'll eventually go over that. Maybe I'll go over that tomorrow night. I don't know. But like I said, the literature is full of papers that says, 2-to-1 is efficient and it's effective, and applying more potassium is usually unnecessary. There's very few that deviate from that. And when they do deviate, there's usually a reason for that that needs to be contextualized. Snyder in 1990 found no Bermuda grass growth response to various potassium sources. And I didn't go over the Snyder and Cesar 1990 paper. I think that's the slow... No, that's not the slow release paper. That might be the... Oh, it is. Control release potassium. Yeah, it is the slow release paper. And they found no Bermuda grass growth response to the slow release potassium sources. I can go over that. It's not a very strong... I mean, it's a good paper, but it's not published in a very good journal. I think it was an international journal. But they found that potassium in the tissue goes up, but the turf grass response didn't really change when you have these slow-release potassium sources. This study is going to be conducted in northwest Alachua County, and in that area, it's an Arredondo fine sand, a very fine sugar sand material. And I wanted... he shows here a little more clearly exactly how much sand we're talking about. Arredondo fine sand is composed of 96% sand. So 960 grams per kilogram. So 960 grams out of 1,000 grams is sand. It's a lot of sand. And it has a cation exchange capacity of 7.7. So I wouldn't necessarily say that's a really low CEC, but it's certainly not high, Thus, the potential for potassium leaching is great. Sartain in 95 actually reported significant potassium leaching from that particular soil. Okay. Unfertilized Arredondo fine sand typically contains very low malic 1 extractable potassium levels. Although the effects of potassium on turf grass have been studied for decades, there is no consensus among turf grass managers as to the proper potassium fertilization program. Isn't that the truth? I mean, it's 2024 and that's still true. There's no consensus among turf grass managers. I'd say there's a pretty good consensus among turf grass scientists, and that is you probably don't need to apply near as much as you're applying. Okay? But even in 2000, 24 years ago, there's no consensus, and there's still no consensus among turf grass managers. This research was undertaken to evaluate the influence of potassium fertilization rate and source on TIF-weight Bermuda grass shoot growth, root density, visual quality, and tissue potassium concentrations. I'm going to read the materials and methods, and then I'm going to read the chat, and then I'm going to go and show the results in PowerPoint. A 3-year study was initiated at the G.C. Horn Turfgrass Field Laboratory in Gainesville, Florida. This is, if you're familiar with Alachua County, it's up near the Devil Millhopper area of northwest Alachua County. Deep sands, Arredondo fine sand. It was conducted on an established TIF-weight Bermuda grass growing on an Arredondo fine sand of a pH of 6.6. The malic 1 extractable potassium prior to treatment was 17 parts per million. Now, I've mentioned it before, on this particular sand, on this specific sand, there has been a correlation made between Mahlach 1 and Mahlach 3, and it's essentially a 1-to-1. It just a fraction more potassium is extracted using Mahlach 3 than Mahlach 1. So if it's 17 Mahlach 1, it might be 18 Mahlach 3. So, but for the most part, it's the same. Okay. So if you're trying to convert this in your mind, what would be Mahlach 3? I would say it's still less than 20. So I would have the position that if you're not seeing acceptable turf grass on this soil and your Mahlach 3 or Mahlach 1 potassium is less than 20, then it's possible that you might be observing a potassium deficiency. Okay. Two potassium sources, KCl and SOP, which is potassium chloride or muriate of potash, and potassium sulfate, were applied at 8 rates. Okay. Now, they're going to do something in this study that I think if Dr. Sartain were here, I think he would acknowledge that he probably would have done it different, because there's a little bit of a quirk in the data, and he acknowledges that in the text. So I'm going to read through it. And the reason I'm saying that is I wouldn't put a lot of confidence in the results of this study when it comes to the differences between the two potassium sources, because there might have been a little quirk in the methodology that could have skewed that. And he acknowledges that in the text. So the potassium rates were 0.75 pounds, 1.5 pounds, 2 pounds, 3 pounds, 4.5 pounds, 6 pounds, or 7 pounds of potassium every 90 days. And they did 2 90-day cycles in a year. Okay, we're in North Florida. Grass grows until like around the Bermuda grass grows until about the 1st of November, something like that. And it comes out of dormance. It doesn't really even go dormant, but it slows way down and then comes out like in March. So they did half the year, basically. They considered half the year to be the growing season. So they did 2 90-day cycles each year. But that's the rates of potassium. It goes from 0 and it has, you know, 8 different rates all the way up to 7.5 pounds every 3 months. And they did it once and then they waited for that 90-day cycle and they did it again for the next 90-day cycle. So they did 180 days, 2 90-day cycles. Since only 1 90-day cycle was evaluated in 1996, potassium and nitrate were more applied 1 and 3 times per year, respectively. Okay, so nitrogen was, and we're going to get to nitrogen in a second. In 1997 and 1998, 2 90-day growth cycles were evaluated. Thus, potassium and nitrogen were applied 2 and 6 times per year, respectively. Nitrogen was applied at 1 pound per 1,000 square feet each month as either ammonium sulfate or ammonium nitrate. To balance the quantity of sulfur applied, ammonium nitrate was used on the potassium sulfate plots, and ammonium sulfate was used on the potassium chloride plots. So he attempted, he knew when he was using two different potassium sources, he knew that the application of potassium sulfate was applying sulfate and potentially biasing the data because the turf grass might actually respond to that sulfate. Whereas the chloride from potassium chloride, the chances are zero, basically, that you'd ever see a beneficial response to chloride. So he knew his data might be skewed because if he didn't account for the sulfate. So he attempted to account for the sulfate by applying sulfate in the plots that received chloride, right? And then not applying any more sulfate to the plots that received potassium sulfate. But in so doing, he applied two different nitrogen sources. And that actually can skew the data also. So I think if he had to do it again, he probably would have chosen to use something like gypsum in the KCl plots to provide that sulfate or some other sulfate nutrient, some other carrier that contains sulfate that didn't have such a pronounced influence on the soil pH, such as ammonium sulfate did. Anyway, so that's the layout of the treatments. He applied nitrogen every month for 6 months, and he applied potassium every 3 months for 6 months. Okay, and he has seven different or eight different potassium rates, two different potassium sources on Bermuda grass. Clippings were returned except when collections were made. So potassium was the leaf tissue is always being returned to the plots. It's not being harvested off. So the potassium is not being intentionally removed in the leaf clippings. Root samples were collected every 2 weeks. Visual quality ratings were on 1 to 9, with 5.5 being minimal acceptable. And then he did, since the study involved the use of potassium rates and one of the objectives was to determine the rate at which no additional response to applied potassium was obtained, single degree of freedom contrasts were generated with general linear model procedures. So reason I'm saying that is you're not going to see a lot of letters that are a little bit more clear to determine differences. He's going to do single degree contrast. And I'm going to show that in the graph format. It's a little bit less user-friendly, I guess, or layman-friendly to see which ones differed from which ones. But I'll do my best to interpret that when I get to the data. Before I go to the results, let me read some, if there's any chat. Okay, oh, Jeremy Beasley, okay. So you pronounce your name Beasley, thank you. Turf Nerd Lawn Care, good morning. You made it, yes you did. Okay, let's get to the results. I'm going to show the results in this PowerPoint. And what I'd like to do is, I'd like to go through the results and I'll go back to the PDF and read a few things in the results and conclusions that I think are better verbalized than visualized. And then I'll wrap it up with some soil test timing, the time of year that you would probably want to consider soil testing is also very clear in this paper. So the graph I'm looking at, gentlemen and ladies, is the effect of potassium on clipping yield in 1997. And on the x-axis, for those listening, we have zero potassium all the way to 7.5 pounds of potassium and root dry weight on the y-axis. So this shouldn't say root dry. This is clipping yield. Okay, it says root dry weight, but it should be clipping yield. Okay, and what we find is when you see a bar under the same line, those are all statistically similar. But because he did single degree contrast, I put this dotted line here because this isn't, not all of these are similar to each other, but they're different from these. They're different from the high ones. So for those listening, when potassium was applied at 0, 3/4, 1.5, or 2 pounds, the clipping yield was less than when it was applied at 4.5, 6, or 7.5 pounds. So there was a benefit to clipping yields.
This
is correct. This is correct. I'll make sure I'm not talking about the wrong thing here. There was a benefit. There's an increase in clipping yields once from 0 to 2 pounds of potassium, but anything greater, they're all the same. There wasn't any value in applying more and more potassium once you hit 3 pounds of potassium in 1997. Okay. But what I'm saying, showing this dotted line is that there was probably an increase from 0 to 3/4 and from 3/4 to 1.5 pounds, but he didn't show those differences. He did single degree contrast. So he grouped he compared this rate here to all of these up here, all of the ones up here. And he said, this is less than all of these four. And 1.5 pounds is less than all the rates combined above 3. And, 3/4 of a pound was less than all the rates combined above 3. I hope that makes sense. It's a little bit different than what you're used to probably seeing when I show these results. But just want to make sure that that's clear, that we're not doing individual comparisons from one treatment to the next. We're comparing one rate to the group of higher potassium rates. And what this says is there's no need to apply more and more potassium. You don't see any benefit in clipping yield in 1997 once you get to 3 pounds every 3 months. In 1998, it was a little bit different where the maximum clipping yield occurred at 2 pounds. Now, this 2 pound potassium every 90 days is the equivalent of 2 parts nitrogen to 1.5 parts potassium. And this 1.5 pounds of nitrogen or 1.5 pounds of potassium here is a 2-to-1 in decay. And how do I come up with that? The 1.5 pounds of K twice is 3 pounds a year. And nitrogen was applied monthly 6 times a year. That's 6. So we have 6 pounds of nitrogen compared to 3 pounds of potassium. So this right here is the 2 to 1, 1.5 pounds of K. And the 2 pounds of K is the just a little bit more than 2 to 1, but it's still less than a 1 to 1. It's like a 2 to 1.5 pounds of K. Okay. And we saw the maximum clipping yield occur at that 2 to 1, a little bit more than 1, 2 to 1.5, something like that. And applying more and more K didn't increase clipping yields at all in 1998. So it's not, in other words, it's definitely not a 1 to 1. The maximum yield occurred with an N-to-K ratio less than 1 to 1. It was more like a 2 to 1 or 2 to 1.5. Okay. So what this means is, and doesn't even know what it means. What it concludes is that applying a 1 to 1, which would have been this one right here, this 3 pounds of K would have been wasteful. Okay. When you see this 3 pounds every 90 days, which is 6 pounds a year, he also applied 6 pounds of N per year. And nowhere did we see a value or benefit to applying that much potassium compared to applying a little less potassium. So you can save money is the point. Reduce any other potential harmful effect of potassium and save money by not applying a 1 to 1 on Bermuda grass in this particular study. Let's go to tissue potassium. That same graph, we're going from X is on 0 to 7.5 pounds of K. And on the y-axis, we have tissue potassium in grams per kilogram, but I'll convert it to percentages. And we see when we apply 0 potassium, the percentage of potassium in the leaf tissue is 1.1. When we go to 3/4 of a pound of K, it's 1.4. When we go to 1.5 pounds of K every 90 days, it's 1.5. And then when we go to 2 pounds of K, which is a 2 parts nitrogen to about 1.5 parts potassium, we have 1.6 in the, percent potassium in the leaf tissue. And then adding more and more K didn't help. So we didn't see any additional potassium in the leaf tissue by continuing to pump out the potassium. Just keep putting it on, keep putting it on, keep putting it on. We didn't see any benefit to that. This right here, this 6 is a 1 to 2 into K. This 7.5 is a 1 to 2.5 into K. And there's just no benefit in terms of yield or in terms of tissue potassium. The benefit occurred when a little bit of potassium was applied, up to about a 2 to 1 into K ratio, maybe a little bit more than a 2 to 1 in this particular study, 2 to 1.5, and then further additions of potassium was wasteful. Let's look at tissue K in 1998, and essentially you see the same thing. From 0 to 1.5 pounds of potassium every 90 days, you see a pretty linear increase from 1% in the tissue to 1.4% in the tissue, and then you add more and more potassium, you don't see any further increase in leaf tissue potassium. You're not going to get, you're not going to get a linear increase in potassium in the tissue. I'm going to apply more and more K's because I need to make sure it's all out there, and I need to make sure the potassium is in the tissue, make sure the soil is loaded with potassium. I mean, you can do that. It's just extremely wasteful. You're not gaining anything once you hit a certain point, and that point appears to be around a 2.1 into K. Remember, this is a sandy soil, 96% sand with low potassium, okay? So imagine a situation where you're not with 96% sand and you have medium to high potassium. You're very likely never going to see these benefits. You see the benefits on sandy soils with low potassium, no potassium-bearing minerals, and you see the benefit on early on with the low rates here. Whoops. With the low rates of potassium. That's when you see the benefit. And just and this idea that you're just going to keep pumping it out there and luxury consumption potassium. I got to get that luxury consumption in there. There might be a little luxury consumption. I'm not arguing that. But you're not going to see any benefit in terms of tissue K or in terms of yield or in terms of quality, which I'm going to get to. Okay. Effect of potassium on roots of Tifway Bermuda grass. Same graph. 0 to 7.5 pounds of K on the x-axis and root dry weight on the y-axis. And we see no benefit at all in terms of the root mass. Root mass was 6.7 with 0 potassium. None was applied. And the root mass was the same as if 7 was applied. 6.6 and 6.7 grams per kilograms per cubic meter. So in this particular study, whether you applied no potassium or whether you applied 7.5 pounds every 90 days, nothing happened with the root mass. And then you've heard me say that many times before. I don't know why people get so hung up on roots. It just, you don't see a lot of stuff going on with roots. Okay, we did show a study once or twice that there was an influence, but most of the time there's not. Now I'm going to come back to this graph or this particular graph in just a minute. I'm going to go back to the PDF real quick. All those numbers were from these graphs, okay, guys? I'm going to read the shoot tissue K I already went over. Root growth I already went over, okay? Those were all those graphs. Shoot growth rate, those are the graphs I just showed, okay? So I'm going to skip through this because I already mentioned it. I want to go down to quality and read this because he doesn't even show. And it's you know, it's disappointing to someone like me who wants to see the numbers that when there's no differences, people will just say data not shown because there were no differences. And I get that. I mean, sometimes that comes from the editor. It's like, you don't need to put all these data in here because there's no differences. But I'd still like to see it, okay, just to be able to show, you know, stuff like this on PowerPoint 25 years later, what actually happened numerically. But that's okay. So the quality ratings were not influenced by potassium in any year. Oh, Lord. I mean, how many times have I said that? How many papers have I said that? It was mostly on cool season grasses and people wanted me to show warm season grasses. It doesn't differ. Sometimes there are nutritional differences between warm season and cool season grasses, notwithstanding the time of year you apply it. I mean, obviously there's going to be a difference there in most cases, but the actual amount you apply and the type of nitrogen and type of nutrient you apply is just going to change based upon your growing season, the length of your growing season mainly. Okay. If your growing season is only 90 days and you're in northern Minnesota, then you're not going to apply as much as you are in South Florida. Because the growing season is longer. The growing season is 12 months in South Florida. But the difference between cool season and warm season grasses regarding their nutritional requirements, there are clearly differences. I don't want to act like there's not. There's clearly differences among them, okay? But you don't really see a whole lot of differences in the literature. Like, you should apply, you know, X amount of potassium to warm season, and you should apply more potassium to cool season or less potassium to cool season. It's usually just to do with the length of the growing season. And the quality ratings right here, it says they weren't influenced by potassium. This is a warm season paper. Okay. Turf grass quality remained high throughout the study. The mean quality ratings range from 6.7 to 6.9. And 6.9 to 7.2. And from 7 to 7.4 in 1996, 1997, and 1998. So every year, the turf grass quality... Remember, the quality minimum was 5.5, and we're a full point above that in the first year, a little bit greater above that in the second year, and then a point and a half greater than that in the third year. So even without applying any potassium, the quality was the same as applying 7.5 pounds every 90 days. So in this case, straight up your ammonium sulfate or straight up ammonium nitrate is all you needed. That's what this paper says. They don't have the data on quality, but that's what this paragraph is saying. Quality ratings were not influenced by potassium. Even when none was applied, it was the exact same as when you applied these copious amounts of potassium, 7.5 pounds every 90 days. It's crazy. Somewhat lower ratings were recorded early in the growing season. But at no time was there any improvement in visual quality related to potassium applications. So you have to understand, whenever you're writing stuff like this, the scientific writing is, you have to be succinct. You can't be repetitive. You can't say the same thing over and over and over. Editors will catch that. Reviewers will catch that. Authors should catch that. You don't want to you're not meandering through your thoughts like I do on this channel. Okay, you have to be straight to the point, say it, move on. And yet he still says it twice. He says it at the beginning, quality rates were not influenced. And three sentences later, he says, at no time was there any improvement in visual quality related to K application. So good for him. He's making a point, okay? His point is potassium wasn't needed. especially these very high rates of potassium. Okay. Growth rate was increased by potassium application, but the response did not translate into a visual improvement in quality. The lack of response to potassium on TIFWA quality may be related to the return of clippings. True. Clippings were returned in this in the study we're talking about today, but they were removed from the Snyder-Cesar 2000 paper. In the Snyder-Cesar 2000 paper, they also started with low potassium, 10 parts per million metric one, but they removed the clippings. So they were harvesting potassium out of the soil continuously for 2 or 3 years. And in that case, they actually did see a response quality-wise. When they're intentionally trying to lower the potassium down so low that you would see a response to it. In that case, they saw a quality response. But in this case, the clippings were returned. They didn't see any quality response. Okay. So he doesn't show the data, but that the quality wasn't influenced at all. The soil analysis now. So let's go back to the PowerPoint because I want to make this abundantly clear. The PowerPoint that I stopped on, the title is called The Effect of Season on Extractable Soil Potassium. The x-axis has the potassium rates from 0 to 7.5 pounds every 90 days. And on the y-axis, we have malic 1 potassium in parts per million. What we're going to see here within each one of these rates, we're going to look at the effect of taking a soil sample in the spring compared to the summer, compared to the fall, with no, when no potassium was applied, all the way up to when 7.5 pounds of potassium was applied. So when we look in the fall and you take, boop, that didn't work. When you look in the fall, at zero, when no potassium was applied, he found, he reported that 19 parts per million potassium was extracted from the soil. And of course, you apply more and more potassium, you see more and more extractable potassium in the soil. You applied zero, you got 19. You applied 7.5 pounds every 90 days, it went up to 85. Okay, so you increased it by a factor of 4, basically, in the soil. And it's a pretty consistent linear increase from 3/4 to 1.5 to 2 to 3 to 4.5 to 6 to 7.5. It's a pretty consistent increase in the soil extractable potassium as you increase the application of potassium. When you go to the summer from the fall, if you'd taken the same sample in the summer, the question I have is, what time of the year should you consider taking the sample? You should take the sample when the potassium is at its lowest. In the summertime, it's lower. Okay. The zero potassium treatment went from 19 to 17. And the 7.5 pounds of potassium went from 85 to 59. Now remember, he's applying potassium twice a year in 90-day cycles. Okay. So at the beginning of the season, there was no potassium he hadn't applied any potassium yet. And then he applied 7.5 pounds, for example, and you see it go up. And then in the middle of the summer, which is the end of the first 90-day cycle and the beginning of the second 90-day cycle, he applied another 7.5 pounds. And that's the difference here when you see he goes from 59 to 85. So if you're applying potassium throughout the year, throughout the growing season in the summer, you're going to have increased levels of potassium from when you started to when you end. Okay. This was taken in October, I think it was, the fall application or the fall treatment. But in the spring, before you start applying it, and after the winter's gone through, so after the summer, the previous year has already been applied, you've already been mowing it, and you shut it down in November, the grass stopped growing, and then the winter comes along, you haven't been applying anything, you haven't been doing anything to the plots, and before the season starts, you take another sample in the spring, that's when the potassium is at its lowest. When no potassium was applied at all, it went from 19 in the fall, 17 in the summer, and 16 in the spring. When no potassium was applied at all. So this is why I'll say under these conditions, if you want to take a soil sample you want to take a soil sample at a time when it's very likely that the nutrients will be at their very lowest, so that if you have a deficiency, you're able to identify it. You want to take that in the spring, because these data clearly show that the spring was when the nutrient, and potassium in this case, was at its lowest. Not in the summer, after you've been applying a little bit of potassium. Not in the fall, after the season's over with, and you've been applying potassium all season. You don't want to do that. Even in North Florida, where it's 96% sand and 50 inches, 60 inches of rain a year, it's still going to be greatest in the fall and least in the spring. Okay? So I want to make sure that that's abundantly clear, is that this is why I say that. And under these conditions, at least, I do not recommend taking a sample in the middle of the summer or at the end of the season, because that's when your nutrient levels are very likely to be at their greatest. Wait until, you know, February, March. I forget exactly when he took that sample. I think it was actually May. May, he took it at the very beginning of May, before he actually started the actual applications. And then he noticed, okay, well, this is when the soil is at its lowest. He knew that's what's going on. Then he starts applying potassium, right? So we go back to the paper. We're going to conclude this and we're going to wrap it up and be done. So if we go back to the paper, that all those graphs were pulled right from this table right here, table three. That's where I pulled all those numbers. So just in case you want to see them, that's where the numbers came from. Okay, now, no growth or tissue potassium response was observed when the application of potassium was 2 pounds every 90 days or greater. And the malic 1 extractable potassium levels were 31 to 47 parts per million. These findings suggest that the current interpretation of malic 1 soil test results for Bermuda grass may not be correct, and that the sufficient malic 1 extractable potassium should be adjusted downward to a possibly as low as 30 parts per million. So here, this little conclusion right here, 30 parts per million, is why I generally will use that number with Bermuda grass in Florida. It very likely could be lower than 30 parts per million. But I don't need to hypothesize what may or may not occur by some other method. I can look in the literature and it says it right there. It says it right there, plain as day. 30 parts per million, that's the cliff. So you want to back it off of 30. You don't want to be on the cliff, right? But clearly, if you're 50, 60, or greater parts per million, there is almost no chance, according to these results, that you're going to see a beneficial response to applying potassium to Bermuda grass in Florida, at least under these conditions. 30 is probably the minimum. And I would argue you don't want to be right on that cliff. Like I've said with my analogies I've used with my family, I don't want them walking next to that cliff. I want them to have a safe distance from it. And that's what I recommend for you guys. I'm going to lower it down to 30. Well, you can. If you're no problem assuming that risk, go ahead. You'll save some money, but you're also assuming a lot of risk. Because it doesn't go from, your turf quality won't go from acceptable to it's kind of acceptable when you go from 30 parts per million K to 10. It's going to drop rapidly. Okay, the quality is going to drop rapidly. It's literally a cliff, and I've shown many regression charts on the channel that show that. Okay, so maybe you want to be 40, 35, 40. That's a safe distance from the cliff. Okay, but it's in the literature. You just got to know where to go find it. It's sitting right here, staring us in the face. It's in the literature. 30 parts per million, malic 1. But malic 3 would be about the same, 31 maybe, 32. When a critical minimum this is the conclusion. So now we're going to conclude this and wrap this up, and I'll go back to the chat at the very end and answer any questions you have in the chat. When a critical minimum potassium tissue concentration was achieved, which was approximately 1.5 milligrams per kilogram tissue, so 1.5%, additional potassium does not result in additional potassium uptake, shoot growth, or improved visual quality or root growth in Tifera Bermuda grass. So once you hit 1.5, that's it. In the tissue, there's no need to put more and more and more. And that amount, that percentage was achieved but about a 2 to 1, 2 to 1.5, something like that. It wasn't necessary to apply more and more K, 1 to 1, 15, 5, 15s. I don't know how many thousands of tons of fertilizer that I've seen go out in Florida that are 15, 5, 15s, 15, 0, 15s on golf courses. 15, 5, 15, I don't need to spend, send me 15, 5, 15 with Rostar, 15, 5, 15 with Barricade, whatever. It's just this repetitive historical action that we have to break the cycle, right? We have to snap that cycle to where, you know, we the next generation coming up recognizes, wait a second, why am I applying that potassium? The literature says I don't need to. I can save that money. Adjust the blend, make it a 20-0-10 or make it a 20 or 30-0-15 or whatever. Become more efficient with that application, right? But still today, thousands of tons of 15-0-15s and 15-5-15s go out in Florida on Bermuda grass. I don't know. We got to figure out some way to break that cycle because it seems like it's got a grip on us. But it says right here, you're not going to get any more potassium in the tissue once you hit 1.5%. In this study on Bermuda grass, monthly variations in root dry weight were observed, but application of potassium did not result in additional root growth. Critical malic one extractable levels of soil K appeared to be near 30 parts per million. Information collected throughout this 3-year study suggests that potassium rates in excess of a 2-to-1 or a 2-to-1.5 times that of nitrogen. So 2 parts nitrogen, 1 part potassium, or 2 parts nitrogen, 1.5 parts nitrogen, do not result in additional tissue potassium uptake, shoot or root growth, or enhanced visual quality. I mean, you're not going to get much more of a clear, succinct conclusion than that. Okay, he went all the way up to 7.5 pounds every 30 or every 90 days, all the way up to a 1 to 2.5, you know, fertilizer of N to K. No need. Put out a 2-to-1. I would put out a 1-to-0. Okay, I mean, I wouldn't even put out any K unless I had a good reason. But if I had a good reason, put out a 2-to-1, 30-0-15, 20-0-10, something like that. And any benefit you're going to get from the potassium, this paper concluded, you're going to get it from that ratio, 2-to-1. Same thing happened with the Cesar Snyder paper, or the Snyder and Cesar paper. Same conclusion. Around a 2-to-1 is what they found you needed on Bermuda grass in Florida. Okay? Let's go to the chat and see if there's anything. Charles Wallace, good morning. Sorry, I don't recognize that name, but welcome. If you've been here before, I apologize. If you haven't, then welcome. Says, Dr. Shaddix, can you do a show or comment on MSMA and the soils and the myth of the conversion of the arsenic? Well, I can if there's a paper on it. You know, I'll be happy to cover that as long as there's a paper on it. I'm not a soil arsenic conversion expert, MSMA conversion expert. But if there's a weed biologist or a soil chemist that has worked with MSMA and published a paper on it, if you know of one, send it to me and I'll go over it. So Randy from Bulgaria asks, so how to know potassium without a soil test? If we look at turf quality by eyes and apply only nitrogen, we can fall off the cliff. How to prevent it? 2-to-1 N to K. Well, potassium deficiencies in turf grass are pretty easy to diagnose, pretty easy to see. I'm still looking for that photo from my Twitter account that I can't find. I have a very clear photo of a leaf that's exhibiting potassium deficiency. Very easy to identify. By tomorrow night, I'll make a point of finding that photograph, or if I can't find it, I'll find some way to show you on Thursday night, the Thursday night show, what a potassium deficiency looks like. And I know, Randy, you're not going to be able to watch it live, but you can watch it the next morning. Of what it looks like in the plant, which leaf it occurs on first, and what the leaf looks like when there's a potassium deficiency. It's not particularly difficult to diagnose. Okay. But let's say worst case scenario that you can't diagnose it, you don't have the skills, or you don't want to learn the skills, or whatever the case is, and you're like, you know what, I'm not confident that I can actually diagnose that. If that's the case, then just do a 2-to-1 N to K. And if you have a deficiency, that's probably going to cure it. Don't do a 1-to-1. Don't do a 1-to-2. You don't need to go out with straight potassium at 3 pounds of potassium. You don't need to do that. So if you're so inclined, if you know, I agree. I mean, you know, if you don't know how to diagnose it and you're unable, you're not confident, then just put out 2:1 into K. Okay. And just put out a little bit of potassium. Don't put out a lot. And if you had a potassium deficiency, that would solve it. Okay. Very, very likely that would solve it. Yeah. So I've heard that before, Randy. This, the question was, personally, he looks for dandelions as an indicator, as I'm not a pro. And I there is certainly some relationship between some weed species and some nutrients in the soil. That is virtually without question. Okay, but what the relationship is between dandelions and potassium, and I don't want to say anything incorrect, so I'm not a weed biologist, so I'm not real knowledgeable in that literature, but I'm fairly certain there's something there, but I'd have to look up that literature or get a specialist on here to actually confirm that that's true or not, the relationship between potassium in the soil and dandelions. There may be something there if I recall, but let me check on it. Juan Roca Gonzalez, good morning. Welcome if this is your first time. Juan Roca Gonzalez asks, Dr. Shattucks, what are the benefits of core and spike aeration? If you go back into the channel on the playlists, I go over core and spike aeration with regards to their influence on thatch, which is minimal, but there's some benefit there on thatch. And I haven't yet gone over any benefit to aeration in terms of soil compaction. I don't think I've covered that to any great extent yet, but I will. I'll put that on the list of things to go over. But in general, what I would say as a general rule is don't do anything unless you have a good reason. Think about the problem more than the solution. So if you're going to be doing aerification, what problem are you trying to solve? Because the aeration is a solution. It's the solution to what problem? And if you say compaction, then I'm going to ask you, how do you know your turf grass is unacceptable as a result of compacted soil? So think about the problem much more than the solution. Because the reason I say that with specific to that question is that aerification, long-term aerification that's not necessary, can actually be detrimental in some cases. You're fracturing the soil structure. You're breaking apart you're degrading the soil structure whenever you aerify the soil. In some cases, that might be necessary. But when it's not necessary, then it wouldn't have a beneficial effect. It would either have no effect. Aerification would either have no effect on turf grass quality, or it would have a detrimental effect long-term because you're degrading the soil structure, okay? So aerification and verticutting, all those things are very useful and very necessary if you have the problem that they're intended to solve. But make sure you have the problem before you just go out there blindly aerify because, oh, it's that time of year, I'm going to aerify. Got to aerify 4 times a year in Florida. I got to start in June, and June, July, August, September. I got to aerify in summertime when nobody's playing golf. That might be necessary if you have a problem that it'll solve. If you don't have the problem, I wouldn't do it. I would refrain from doing anything unless you have a good reason. And the good reason is you have a problem that's resulting in unacceptable turf grass, and this solution has evidence to support solving that problem. Okay, guys, I'm gonna leave you with some music. I'll be on tomorrow night, Thursday night. I'll do my best to find a photograph that does this potassium deficiency between now and then. If I don't, I can't, but I'll do my best. Until then, be kind. I'll see you guys tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thanks, guys. Gals. See you then. Bye.